This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Governor Peter Shumlin focused his inaugural address this month on energy and the environment. And as he revealed programs to encourage more renewable energy generation, he made this comment about electric rates.
When some of our neighboring states have seen breathtaking increases in electric rates, I read in the paper some of the businesses in New Hampshire last week complaining about 100% increases. We've accomplished all this while our largest utility cut rates by 2.46% last year. Our rates are going down, our neighbors' rates are going up. We're getting this right.
Okay, so do you know how that works? How rates are set and what utilities are required to do by the state government? Most people don't, and even some lawmakers scratch their heads about the particulars of energy regulation. So this week, the legislature is getting a three-day crash course. The Vermont House Natural Resources and Energy Committee invited the Regulatory Assistance Project to give members an overview of, quote, the foundations of energy regulation, the history of regulation and policy in Vermont and the region, and of what's on the horizon. They're right in the middle of these sessions, and today on the program, we're going to talk with Richard Sedano. He's the Director of U.S. Programs for the Regulatory Assistance Project, or RAP. It's a Vermont-based energy policy advising organization. Sedano was also Commissioner of Vermont's Department of Public Service for 10 years in the 1990s. Rich, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jay. Nice to be with you.
So up until the 1990s, electric utilities operated in states around the country as monopolies. And then around the country, there came this period of broad deregulation with the intention that competition would help lower electric rates for consumers. Some states tried it. Vermont didn't really do it. Vermont never really went in that direction of deregulation. Was that a wise move for the state?
Vermont thought about it really hard. I think there were a lot of large businesses that wanted access to what they perceived to be better deals out there. And there was actually a legislative effort to adopt it. But what ended up happening was that we said, well, there, certain conditions would have to be met in order for us to have retail electric competition for electricity in Vermont. And we couldn't really meet those conditions. We couldn't assure people that prices would go down, and we couldn't assure well enough that interest would be protected, and so we set it aside. We decided to make a few changes to regulation. We created Efficiency Vermont. We adopted net metering, and we later adopted an alternative form of regulation that helps take some of the risk out of the utility business, and that benefits customers. All of those were thought about during the retail competition discussion and were saved after the retail competition effort itself failed. Around the country, really only a couple of states are making anything out of retail competition today. A lot of the other states that tried it, it really didn't take.
So I'm going to time you here, Rich. Can you give us the two-minute thumbnail sketch sort of taking us up to today in how energy regulation does work in the state of Vermont?
Well,
or utility regulation?
Well, we have one large utility, Green Mountain Power, and many smaller municipals and co-ops around the state. And each of them are responsible for the service in their territory. And each of them are entitled to get the revenues to deliver all the services that we want from their customers. And so from time to time, we do something called a rate case where we examine what it is that it costs to do all the things that we want them to do. And then after we figure out what it costs, we figure out then what the prices need to be. And for the investor-owned companies, They have shareholders and debt for which they need to ensure a firm flow of capital. So we determine a target level of profit that they make, and that also is added to the revenue that they require. For the municipals and co-ops, they just have debt, and the cost of that debt goes into their rates too. So that's how the rates get set. And, of course, there are a lot of details which, for example, that volatility issue that the governor talked about, why Vermont prices are different from other people, that draws directly from the way we regulate our utilities.
We're learning today about utility regulation. It may seem dense, and it is dense, but it's hugely important to the state and important to consumers. And you certainly see the effects of that regulation every month in your utility bill. So listeners, you may be curious to learn a little bit more. We're talking with Richard Sedano with the Regulatory Assistance Project. And if you have a question that you'd like him to help answer, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a question on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Rich, you sort of went into some of this a little bit, but for people who are holding their GMP bill or their Washington Electric Co-op bill right now, can you explain what goes into that $50 or $100 that they're paying for that monthly bill?
Well, on the cost side, what goes into it basically are the infrastructure that causes the power to get from wherever it's coming from to your house or to your building. So there's the poles and the wires. There's all the people that manage all of that who plan for the future, the executives, of course. So that's a little less than half of the cost. And the other half of the cost is simply the cost to produce the power from wherever it comes from Hydro-Quebec or from Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant or from the many hydro projects that are around Vermont. That all adds up to a little more than half of the cost. So that's what the cost side looks like. But that's not what you see on your bill. What you see on your bill is a monthly customer charge somewhere between $5 and $10, maybe $11 or $12 a month. So this is what you pay just to be on the system, to be connected to the system every month. And if you use nothing, that's what you pay anyway. And then if you're a residential customer, I think everything else on the bill is charged on a kilowatt hour basis. It would be nice if there was just one number, but unfortunately, for various reasons, there are a few lines on the bill. But you can add them up, and what you pay is based on the number of kilowatt hours you use. So if the average is somewhere around 500 kilowatt hours, you multiply that by whatever the number is, 14 or 15 cents, and you get the dollars that you pay. If you're a business customer, you might also have a demand charge. That means that at the hour where you use the most power, there's a certain amount of power that's coming in, and you pay actually for that as a distinct payment from the energy charge. And this encourages business customers to manage their peaks, to try to reduce their peaks, to reduce their bills, and that actually comes back and helps the utility if business customers can do that.
And you mentioned that the rate per kilowatt hour, there's a lot that goes into that. And is some of that what the utility is actually paying to get that power themselves, and then some of the other costs that go into it, those line costs, or is that fixed cost that you pay just by being a customer? Is that where that goes into?
Yeah, the cost per month really is just to pay for the facilities right near your building. So it ought to be maybe a little smaller, but it ought to be just basically the line drop, the pole-mounted transformer outside, and really close facilities close to your house, because those are the facilities that serve you. But the facilities that serve all of us that are shared, those we charge for on a per kilowatt hour basis, sort of the way we buy gasoline. You know, when you buy gasoline, it's all a volumetric per gallon price. You don't have to pay a dollar just to start the pump. And so gasoline is entirely a volume business. With power, we charge a little bit to connect you, and then the rest of it is a volume business.
Got it. And the costs for the lineman and the payment for the CEO, that all goes into the cost per kilowatt hour that you're paying.
That's right. And we don't break all those things out. Sometimes somebody wants to break one of the charges out, and the response is always, well, let's break all the charges out. And that usually stops that conversation.
Can you explain how a rate of return is established? So obviously, these companies, these utilities need to make some money, depending on, you know, whether they're a co-op or whether they're a for-profit company. But can you explain how the rate of return is established?
Sure. And the reason this is important is because it's very important for capital to be available to utilities in order to keep reinvesting in the system. And so we don't want shareholders to continue to be interested in the company for that same reason. So there's a few different methods, technical methods, that the regulators use. But basically, it's about expectations. If we allow the utility to make a return on equity investment of 10%, let's say, which is a rough number that represents what's going on today. And that means that the flow of capital comes at a reasonable cost. Utilities are pretty highly rated companies in terms of debt. And so that strikes the right balance. If we lowered the return to a lower number, then that might feel good, but the cost of borrowing and the cost of raising equity capital would go up, and ratepayers actually would be hurt by that if we put the return on equity too low. Likewise, if we make it too high, then that's just basically giving away money that the utilities don't really need, and so we don't make it too high either. So balance is a word that is very often used in this, and there's no precise formula. There's several different ways of figuring it out. People who are home assessors might get that, you know, when you do comps for similar homes, when somebody is putting their home on the market, we kind of do the same thing with utilities. We look at comparable utilities and figure out what they need. That's one of the ways that it gets done.
And the idea here is that the state is regulating that so that a utility can't just say, well, we want to make, 100% return on investment, or, you know, have a profit margin that's so huge that it burdens overdue burden on the customer. So that's where the regulation comes in, is the state is helping with the company set an appropriate rate of return and return on investment.
Well, that's right. The word we haven't used yet is monopoly. The utility is the only entity that's selling us electricity. If we want electricity some other way, we have to go through quite a lot of fuss to do that. So the utility is a monopoly, and we control their prices. We control their allowed rate of return, their profit. And it is important to recognize that while we control those in setting the revenues that ends up setting the prices, then after the rate case is over, time marches on. And if it's a cold winter, they might have a lot of sales. And if one way of regulating would allow them to make a lot of money in that situation, and that's happens around the country a lot. In Vermont, we've changed the way we regulate so that the weather and the business cycle, things like that, actually don't change the prospects of the utilities very much. And what really affects the utilities most is how effective they manage their business, and that's how as it should be.
We're talking about how electric utility regulation works in Vermont. And listeners, if you have a question, you can call now. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. When we come back, we're going to get right into your questions and concerns about how utility regulation works here in Vermont. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Richard Sedano is director of the U.S. Programs for the Regulatory Assistance Project. His organization advises businesses and lawmakers on energy policy, and this week he's leading a three-day workshop for the Vermont legislature to help those lawmakers understand utility regulation. He's giving us the Cliff Notes version, and if you have a question for him, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Cambridge. Hi, Peter. You're on.
Hi. Hello, Richard. My question is regarding energy efficiency Vermont and the fact that I make very, very little money, but I have no option to opt out of the program. I will give you a brief background. I have a degree from the University of Vermont in conservation of energy and natural resources. 1984, and I would like to be able to use the money for Efficiency Vermont that I'm charged of $5 a month or so for my own efficiency projects that are not electric oriented, because I've done everything I can to save money in my own house. I am not happy that some of the Efficiency Vermont money goes to prop up the purchase of efficient guns and whatever else for private businesses such as ski areas, which really should fund their own efficiency programs. So that's a redistribution of poor people's money to wealthier situations. And secondly, the rate of return of 10% on utilities seems quite excessive.
All right, Peter, I want to put that to Richard Sedano here. Peter's talking about what he has to pay for Efficiency Vermont. It's factored into the bills. So what about that?
Sure. In Vermont, the charge that we pay for efficiency is somewhere between 4 and 5% of the total bill amount. And the question is what do we get for that? And what we get for that is avoiding a significant amount of money that would otherwise appear in the 95 or 96% that is not Efficiency Vermont. I think the benefit-cost ratio for what Efficiency Vermont invests in efficiency is roughly 2-to-1. So that means that if you spend a dollar for efficiency services in your bill, somewhere in the system, $2 is going to get saved at some point. Now, it's true that we pay that money today and the efficiency benefits come over time because, you know, when you invest in efficiency equipment, it saves money over time. But Vermont has done pretty well. The position that Vermont is in right now, because of all of the efficiency that's been done in Vermont over the last 25 years, is in part because so much efficiency has been done that has controlled our costs that the bottom line bill would be much higher. The rates would be higher and the bills would be higher if we didn't spend money on efficiency in the past. And looking forward, the same is going to be true, I believe, that the money that's being spent for efficiency today will help control bills tomorrow. And that's the message to people who struggle to make ends meet. Is that this is the way to assure that our own selves in a decade and our kids in a generation will continue to be able to make ends meet. It's really an investment.
I also want to mention we did not too long ago a program where we talked with the head of Efficiency Vermont and talked specifically about how Efficiency Vermont decides to spend money. And we did talk about their initiative to help ski resorts get more efficient snow guns for making snow. We'll put a link to that program on today's show page if you're interested, Peter and others, in listening to how Efficiency Vermont talks about that decision and why they made it. Rich, before the break, we were talking a little bit about return on investment, and we got a note from Labrapotes who says, what is the target return rate on capital the Vermont regulators allow the utilities? Are the utilities regulated in how they can invest their capital? For example, could they build lavish offices and exercise facilities for senior management and expect a fair rate of return on them?
The oversight responsibilities of regulators does allow it to investigate what it spends its money on. In the 80s, Green Mountain Power built a large and very nice-looking corporate headquarters south of Burlington. And I'll just be a little bit indiscreet and say many people called it the Crystal Palace. And some might have said, well, maybe that shouldn't have been quite so nice. Of course, Green Mountain Power, anybody who's seen their current headquarters in Colchester in what I would call modest, a very modest place, which they've spruced up quite nicely when I've visited, I've seen it, would indicate that, yes, it's possible for a utility to focus on the work and not really have any more frills in their workspace than they absolutely need. And so generally, regulators are concerned about the way utilities spend money. They can't address all the details. They tend to focus on the big things. And I think in the future, we're going to see more uses of what I might call big data, more ability for sensors to understand what utilities are doing and be able to process that information, for the use of regulators to be able to be even better aware of the kinds of things utilities are spending money on, whether they're effective. Regulation is not like it's not perfect, but it has to be good enough. And I think for consumers, it's important for them to have confidence that regulation is good enough And then I think regulators and utilities can have some latitude to try new things. I think trying encouraging innovation is an important part of incorporating new clean energy technologies, new information technologies. And regulators are going to be challenged because the utility business is changing, and so being able to be open to doing things next year a little different than we did last year, which is not always an easy thing for regulators or utilities, is going to be increasingly valuable for customers as innovation offers new ways, cheaper ways, more effective ways to provide the services that we want.
I want to pivot to that and talk a little bit about the energy and electricity picture and where we're going and how this landscape is changing, especially with small-scale producers. But just very briefly, before we do, can you explain what incentive regulation is? Because that's a part of the deal here for utilities in Vermont.
Yeah, well, regulation normally means I'm going to get a profit based on the amount of money I invest. And my performance doesn't really matter very much unless it's really bad and the regulators call me on it and penalize me in some way. So where is performance in that conversation? It doesn't really exist in a positive way. And yet with some of the changes that are coming along where customers are going to want to potentially do more with generating electricity on their in their properties, they might want to get more involved with other kinds of services that we don't know about yet. We certainly want good reliability. We want good customer service. Is there a way to motivate companies to do more than is required? So we talk about the difference between compliance and exceptional service. Most people don't describe the service they get from utilities as exemplary or exceptional. And is that okay? Maybe that, for some people, maybe that's okay, but maybe that's because we don't really know what exemplary or exceptional service looks like. And so the question for the public is, are we willing to pay a little more for motivating utilities toward exceptional service? And if that actually benefits us, then there's a value proposition where we're getting something and we're paying something and the exchange is fair. Different states now are starting to think about this to motivate utilities to be more than just delivery companies, but to really be service companies.
Let's go to Chris Recchia, the commissioner of the Public Service Department, who's also calling in for this topic. Hi, Commissioner Recchia. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for the topic. And Rich, hello.
Hi, Chris.
You have an excellent guest to describe this very complicated process to your listeners, and I'm glad you're doing it. Great. I wanted to just mention that I know you touched on, you know, why is Vermont regulated and when other states have chosen to deregulate. And I think, you know, what I've observed since I've been doing this for a couple of years is that Vermont really is in an exceptional place to make sure that we are getting service from our utilities and that they're thinking longer term. In other words, when you look at across the region, we are now benefiting from very stable rates that haven't always been the cheapest, but now they're becoming the cheapest by virtue of the fact of the large fluctuations that some of the other states have seen. And I see investments in our infrastructure that aren't being made in other states. I wonder if, Rich, you could comment a little more on kind of the deregulated ethos and what that looks like in terms of value for customers.
Go ahead,
sure,
Rich.
Sure. In most of New England, natural gas is the primary source of electric generating fuel. Around 40% of the electricity that's delivered in New England was produced in a natural gas-fired power plant. And as we know from natural gas history over the past several years, it's like a roller coaster to watch the prices move from time to time. Right now, we happen to be in a low period, but not so many years ago, it was very high. And at times, the prices can spike, as it did last winter, when there was a sudden cold snap and there was a big demand for gas, and the price went from very low to very high. And the reason that prices around New England are going up so much, but not in Vermont, is because they're more dependent on natural gas than Vermont is. And I would say that over the past really 30 years, Vermont has diminished and kept low its dependence on fossil fuels. Perhaps it's for environment, but I think perhaps the biggest reason was a strategic decision to avoid being stuck in a volatile fuel source that would move prices around so much. So Vermont rates for a long time have been pretty stable. And as Commissioner Recchia has said, sometimes that makes Vermont a little more expensive than other places. But frankly, most times and over the course of time, Vermont has done well with this strategy.
Let's go to Ron, calling in from Irisburg. Hey, Ron, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Ron. I appreciate this conversation. I wonder if Mr. Sedano could explain to the laypeople the interrelationship between utility rates, carbon emissions, and the sale of RECs, renewable energy certificates. Recently, the CEO of Washington Electric Cooperative said that they would experience a double-digit increase in rates if they weren't allowed to sell RECs. And so it seems that the RECs are keeping our rates down, but I'm wondering what's happening to our carbon emissions. For example, in January of 2013, we were supposed to have reached a carbon emission goal, but there wasn't much fanfare that, in fact, we were nowhere near close to that goal. So it seems by selling RECs, we seem to be not reducing our carbon emissions. Could he explain that interrelationship, please?
Yeah, Ron, thanks for the call. Ron, talking about RECs, renewable energy credits. Richard Stano?
Well, this is going to be a challenge, but let me give it a go. First of all, many states in New England, but not Vermont, have a requirement that all the electricity that's sold to customers, some of it has to come from qualifying renewable sources. So this is called a renewable portfolio standard. It's a part of their portfolio has to come from renewable energy. And in New England, we have a way of keeping track of the credits that come from renewable generators and where they come from and where they go. And so these are the renewable energy credits, or RECs, as we call them. Vermont has not had a renewable portfolio standard. And so Vermont has been in the interesting position of basically being a source of RECs for the other states in New England. We produce them here, and we sell them just the same way that we sell computer chips and milk to other places. And that has proven to be a very strategic and cagey strategy, because the money comes back and offsets our electric prices and is to our benefit. However, other states are starting to realize that maybe Vermont should be pulling its own weight in terms of supporting renewables. You might want to think of what Vermont is basically doing. Vermont has a lot of renewable generation, but we're selling all the renewable qualities to somebody else, and so we can't really claim them anymore. And I know some of the utility executives in Vermont sometimes slip up and say, oh, look at all the renewable energy we have in Vermont. Hmm. Well, we've really sold the right to say that, and we're using the money, that's nice, but we've sold the right to say how renewable Vermont is. And I think what's starting to happen is that people are saying, well, maybe Vermont ought to step up and say, we're renewable, and we shouldn't just be selling the rights to that. We should keep the rights. And that's true. A utility like Washington Electric, which has sold a lot of RECs from the Coventry landfill and their Wrightsville Dam and other sources, will suffer if that transition happens too quickly. And so I think that a transition that's more reasonable would be a good thing to do to manage that. And in the meantime, none of this really matters to carbon emissions in the region. Why is that? Because Vermont is part of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and that determines how much carbon the whole region, including Vermont, is going to actually produce You can only produce a carbon unit if you buy an allowance to do that, and so none of this really matters in the whole scheme of things. We'd like to see the carbon limits in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative lowered, but this REC question is separate from that. So I hope that helped and kept the time.
Yeah, Richard, it really did. And this is so interesting to be able to have this sort of electrical utility regulation 101, especially as we enter this brave new world of renewable energy generation and small-scale generation, solar arrays, people who have individual solar panels on rooftops or who are buying into small-scale arrays. So we'll have to look at that separately. But I really appreciate you giving us this really good baseline knowledge, especially as you're also giving it to the legislature this week. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity, Jane.
Richard Sedano is Director of U.S. Programs for the Regulatory Assistance Project. It's an energy policy advising organization in Vermont. And as I mentioned, he is in the middle of 3 days of workshops for lawmakers, helping them understand the basics of utility regulation. Coming up, Almost Famous Women. We'll hear from Vermont author Megan Mayhew Bergman about her new book that explores the lives of women that history has largely forgotten. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Women are a larger part of the labor force than ever before in the United States, but society is still not always kind to women who step out of the boundaries of what's considered acceptable. That's one reason Vermont author Megan Mayhew Bergman wrote a new book of short stories called Almost Famous Women. In the book, she fictionalizes the stories of real women whom history has forgotten. These were strong, unusual women who lived at the fringes of society. A motorcycle-riding trickster, a boat-racing heiress, a feisty aging painter, an all-female multiracial swing band. Producer Sage Van Wing spoke with Megan Mayhew Bergman, who began the interview by reading a passage from one of the stories in her book. The story focuses on Dolly Wilde, the flamboyant niece of Oscar Wilde. She has come back from serving as an ambulance driver on the front lines of World War I and is slowly killing herself with drugs and depression. Here, a childhood friend reflects on her relationship with Dolly.
When I was younger, I wrote her a love letter. I told her that I wanted more from her, that she was beautiful and capable of becoming a great writer and a great human being, and that I could help her if she'd just let me. She was 22 and just back from the war, and I'd missed her so much my stomach hurt, and I ran to greet her when she visited the house. She never responded to the letter and acted as if she hadn't received it. I was too embarrassed to ask, to force the issue. Now, reading her letters, I knew more about the woman I thought I loved. Or maybe I knew less. Maybe what I knew was that there was more mystery and hurt than I could have imagined. Maybe the world had been bad to its great and unusual women. Maybe there wasn't a worthy place for the female hero to live out her golden years, to be celebrated as the men had been celebrated, and to take from that celebration what she needed to survive.
So is that what you were trying to do here in these stories, to create a worthy place for the female hero to live?
That sounds, you know, grand. And I guess in my heart of hearts and deepest dreams, yes. I didn't want these stories and these sacrifices and these risks to go unnoticed any longer. There have been some great biographies written about these women, but many of them are out of print. And for a while I tested, you know, in conversation with friends and other members of the literary community, and I wanted to know if they were aware of these women. And when many of them weren't, I knew it was still time to bring these almost famous women back into a contemporary conversation.
Well, one thing that you do that's interesting is in most of the stories, you actually tell the story from an even further remove. So you tell, it's a first-person narrative from the point of view of people who were close to these almost famous women, but not from their own perspective themselves. Why did you make that choice?
One of the things that's most character revealing, one of the best ways to see someone's character is to watch the way they interact with those closest to them. So with a trusted servant or a lover or a casual lover or a friend, you really see the way people treat each other. And there's a way to witness those individual and highly specific pressures and conversations. And in some of the instances, my best way forward was through a person I could empathize with. So in the Jo Carstairs story, The Queen of Whale Cay, Jo Carstairs was this incredibly powerful, incredibly wealthy, confident woman who owned her own island in the Bahamas and raced boats and was just wild and rugged. And I couldn't quite access that character from a first-person perspective, but what I could find my way into was a young woman from the South who had achieved some small amount of notoriety by performing in a mermaid act in Florida, and Joe had found her there and taken her to Whale Cay, and I thought, okay, that lights my brain up in a more empathetic way, and I'm fascinated by the orbit a lot of people have around fame, what it does to the power dynamic and one's sense of self-worth.
Why do you think so many of the women that you wrote about were lesbians?
It's a great question. I've thought about that, too. There were a couple of traits I noticed about these women after the collection. Most of them were not married or did not remain married. Only two of them had children, and none of them raised their children, the two that had them. And roughly a quarter of them, if not more, were lesbian. And, you know, I don't have any deep theories about it, but what I will say is I think these women had to take great risks at the turn of the century to live the way they wanted to live and to make art and to process the world around them. And they really had to create their own communities in some instances or make great acts of courage. And I think those are the things that stand out.
So because in some ways, because they were forced to be outsiders.
Exactly. They were already sort of operating on the fringes anyway.
You were talking just a second ago about the way you found into the story and the emotion of the second person or the person who was related to them and empathizing with them. I know a lot of people say sometimes about women writers, and I think it's a little unfair, that women writers will talk more about the emotional lives of their characters than male authors do.
Mm-hmm.
Was that anything that you were thinking about when you were writing these characters?
Not so much, honestly. But when I first started writing, I didn't know so much about what the market wanted or what people said about male versus female writers. But as I've been publishing for maybe 6 or 7 years, I have had people say to me, you know, you'll get better critical attention if you write about men.
Huh.
And often somebody has said, you know, glamorous publication X doesn't like first person female or doesn't like, you know, domestic fiction, et cetera, et cetera. But I think there's still many ways to write good quality literary fiction while focusing on women and while focusing on the emotional landscape. That's hard work, and it's morally complex work sometimes. And I find, as an artist, I'm really fascinated by that space between who we want to be and who we actually are, and people that are going after that sort of cognitive dissonance. And I think that's a fascinating universal aspect of humanity to plumb.
Well, some of the complexity of these stories, I think, is the relationship between what you do know about the biographical information of these very real women and then, of course, what you've invented and come up with whole cloth. And in the back of the book, you write about some of the sources for biographical details that you used. Can you talk about the relationship between what you know about the facts of these women's lives and what you've written in the stories?
Sure. Sure. I mean, it was certainly an art that I negotiated with on each story. And I am a bit of a nerd and an academic. I have two master's degrees, and I came at this material first and foremost as an academic, almost from a women's studies perspective. But then, there's so many gaps in their stories that your imagination already has to start doing work anyway. And so I decided not to be puritanical. I said, if I have a story to offer here, and I can offer it well with good intention and try and offer a perspective on the interior landscape of these really fascinating women that we can still learn a lot from, this is a gift, and I can give it to readers, and I can do so carefully. I can include an author's note at the end. I can send them running toward more factual sources, which I know people are doing. In a lot of the reviews of the book so far, the word Googling has come up constantly. And, you know, it makes me feel like my diabolical plan worked, that I said, here's some fascinating women. Let me animate them for you. Let me plug them into your imagination and make you hungry. And then let's talk about them more. Let's research them more. Let's go to the fact.
And in fact, your author's note at the back for your story about the daredevil motorcycle rider, Hazel Eaton, you simply write, quote, let me be intellectually honest here, internet rabbit hole.
Right. Yeah, God forbid we have a sense of humor, right? Yeah, I knew I couldn't lie about that one. I thought, well, I could, you know, come up with some grander idea about where I found out about this. But, you know, my friends and I, some other novelists and short story writers, always talk about how absolutely insane the search history is for a novelist or a short story writer. I mean, if you go into the internet cache, it's just madness, you know, and the internet is a gift and a curse. You know, it's a curse because it takes you away from, you know, the real thoughtful, mindful, creative act sometimes, but it's also a trove of inspiration and material.
That's probably not so different from the Google cache on a journalist's computer.
Right. Exactly.
I saw on your blog that you've received the occasional menacing anti-feminist email because of this book.
I sure do. That's, you know, to me, it's a sign of success. When I first started writing, my first book, Birds of a Lesser Paradise, had a lot of meditations on environmental degradation and our the human as animal. You know, the idea that humans are still animals and we're surprised by our instincts and we sort of think we've transcended this, but we haven't. And I got wonderful hate mail for that concept. And at first it really hurt my feelings. But then after I thought about it some more, I realized good art should not be easy. It should not be a foregone conclusion. It should feel a little dangerous. It should ruffle some feathers. It shouldn't be universally agreeable.
So do you think that the fact that you're getting those emails tells you something about it being the right time for this kind of book about this kind of woman?
I do. I think it's the cultural moment to revisit a lot of these women, especially from a sexuality perspective. I feel that, you know, before a woman's sexuality, especially if it was an alternative sexuality or sexual preference, I feel as though readers and critics might have focused on that, or it might have stood out more than it truly needed to. What I never wanted to do was undermine these women's intentional choices by making them scream too loudly on the page. I wanted to present it as it was, or as I imagined it was, is the correct way to say that.
There are a lot of tough, unique, and strong women here in Vermont. Did you think about that at all?
Absolutely, absolutely. And my friend Tammy White, who is also a blogger and a farmer, fiber farmer, we talk a lot about it, and she was actually talking about Almost Famous Farm Women was her sort of riff on my title. And absolutely, I have met some women who are physically strong and mentally strong and out there, you know, cracking frozen water buckets for their livestock and throwing hay bales and doing it for themselves. And I am absolutely inspired by that.
Megan Mayhew Bergman is the author of Birds of a Lesser Paradise, and her latest book is Almost Famous Women. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bergman will be reading from her book on Saturday, January 24th at 7 p.m. in Manchester at Northshire Books. She spoke with Vermont Edition's Sage Van Wing. The estate of the 6th Baronet of Lindertis, Scotland, is being auctioned by the Boston auction house Skinner. Normally, that wouldn't arouse much interest in Vermont, but Sir Alastair Munro of Lindertis lived in Waitsfield for about 60 years, where he skied and pursued a second career. Munro died last March. VPR's Rickson Gary spoke with the appraiser for the auction house, Carrie Shrives, about the collection.
So you've had two auctions already with some of the items from his estate. Can you give us an overview of the collection that was auctioned?
Well, I guess I would describe it as just very Downton Abbey, a really sort of cohesive group of material that, you know, evokes life in Britain at the turn of the 20th century. So a combination of items that predate that from the, you know, 18th and 19th century up through the Edwardian era.
Now, when you say items, give us an idea of what that includes.
Well, it's everything from Georgian chests of drawers to silver for the table, mice and porcelain, decorative artwork, and collections of typically Scottish souvenirs called Mauchlinware. So transfer decorated souvenirs that were manufactured in Scotland in the 19th century and sold all over the world, depicting local points of interest. And there were a fair number that had Vermont scenes, which was kind of a nice tie-in of both past and present.
Why is this collection of interest to collectors or to antique fans?
Well, I think, you know, antiques hold allure, but certainly a provenance. I think people have an interest in the rich life items have had prior to them owning them. And the idea that items came from a castle in Scotland and they had a, you know, storied history.
Now, Skinner has one more auction coming up with items from Monroe's estate. Tell us about the items being auctioned.
Well, we have an auction coming up of European paintings, and that is on January 23rd in Boston. And there are a number of mostly 19th century landscapes, Italian, British, Scottish artists. Again, some just very typical 19th century works evocative of the time.
Carrie Shrives is the Senior Vice President and Senior Appraiser at Skinner, Inc. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
And Shrives talked with Vermont Edition's Rick Singeri. That's it for today. Raising a child is the most wonderful experience imaginable, except when it's anything but. Author Jennifer Senior says our culture has made parenthood a difficult thing to navigate along with work, relationships, autonomy, and finances. Tomorrow, Senior joins us to discuss her book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Share your stories of parenting by writing to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.